All right. So tonight, I wanted to discuss with you, obviously, related to the holiday of Purim. You know, it's coming already tomorrow night. Tomorrow evening, we are going to usher in the holiday. We're going to listen to the Megillah. And then on Friday, we'll have the other mitzvah. And I mentioned in a previous time that there are four mitzvot that are associated with the holiday of Purim. Right? And they are hearing the Megillah. Number two is having a festive meal. Number three is sending mishloach manot, sending the packages, the ready-to-eat food packages to our friends and family, and to maybe those who are not our friends, even better. And then the fourth is an extra measure of tzedakah called matanot le'evyonim, charity alms for the poor. Those are the four mitzvot for the holiday. The only one that is applicable at night is the listening to the Megillah. The others we do by day. Now, you're welcome to give charity anytime, but the mitzvah is to give it on, that it should be dispersed on Purim day. So for me, I don't necessarily run into people that, you know, I may run into somebody who's collecting, but typically I don't assume that. And therefore, I try to take care of the obligation ahead of time. And I give it to someone who takes care of the poor in the community. And the condition is I give it to him, let's say this week, and I say to him, disperse it on Purim day. He'll give it out. So that Which would be Friday. He will give it out. Probably he'll give it to them Friday, Thursday night, probably is when he'll give it to them Friday. So that the point of it is that they'll have what they need for the Purim meal. Being that the Purim meal this year is very early, to go to them at 11 o'clock and expect them to be able to have the money to go buy what they need so that they can have a meal, that's a little late in the game. So he likely will give it to them probably Thursday or Thursday night. So I know for sure that they'll be taken care of. And then the festive meal and the sending of the packages. Those are the four mitzvot. But be that as it may, I think what we need to do tonight is to look at one aspect that's brought in the story in Megillat Esther, in the book of Esther, that I think, although we know the information, I don't know if we spend enough time analyzing why it's significant. And I find that, as all of you have been in my classes before, that's my MO, right? I very often will choose something that we may know, but then, okay, now let's take a step back and think about this. Why is that, and what can we learn from it? So we open up the Megillah, and we're introduced to the two heroines of the story. You have Mordechai and Esther, okay? They're the two main characters that are the heroes of the story. Well, what do we know about Mordechai? I'll throw it out there. Give me some piece of information that you know about Mordechai, other than his name.
Jewish man in Shushan.
He was what?
A Jewish man in Shushan.
Jewish man who lived in Shushan. Okay, what else?
Uncle. He took in Esther for his brother to raise her.
Okay, he took in Esther to raise her. What'd you say, Sandy?
That he's her uncle.
Correct. Mordechai and Esther are related as uncle and niece. Okay, what else?
He was from the tribe of Benjamin.
Mordechai is from the tribe of Benjamin. Okay. Robin, let me ask you, why does Mordechai raising Esther?
She's an orphan.
Right, because her parents are no longer alive.
Okay. That is correct. Just a quick checkpoint. Does that make any difference in the story? I mean, it's a cool piece of information, and it maybe gives us a little indication about how nice of a guy Mordechai is. But in the actual storyline, does it play a role? It doesn't seem to, does it?
We're supposed to say no, but you're going to say but.
but is right, right? It has to be. We've said this a million times, and I'm not exaggerating. We've said it so many times. There is nothing that is recorded in any of the books, the 24 books of Tanakh, that is there for no reason. It is there not just as a nice piece of information. It is critical to be part of the story. It is no different in the book of Esther. We read the verse. It says as follows. When it introduces us to Mordechai and to Esther, it says, talking about Mordechai, Vayehi omein et Hadassah. He had raised Hadassah. Who's Hadassah? He Esther. This is also known as Esther. Bat Dodo, the daughter, right? Meaning his niece. Why is he raising her? Ki ein la av va'em. For she has no father and mother. She's beautiful. The verse continues. And then it tells us, and she doesn't have her mother and father. Well, as soon as you tell me that she's an orphan, I know she has no mother and father, but it seems as though, as an introduction to who she is, this is a critical piece. And why? What is so critical of the fact that she's an orphan? You can say simply, I don't know, Mordechai, her parents got stuck somewhere else, and Mordechai raised her. Okay, there's a relationship there. But it seems as though there's something more about her specifically being an orphan that's critical. So I'm going to put on the screen the Midrash, right? It's supposed to be a text-based class, so here we go, okay? It's right here by the blue. Everybody see it? I know it's all in Hebrew, and I apologize. I should have brought up an English one as well, but okay. Rabbi Brachia b'shem Rabbi Levi. Rabbi Brachia, that's his name, in the name of Rabbi Levi, said, Amar lahem HaKadosh Baruch Hu Yisrael. God says to the Jewish people, Atem b'chitem, you are crying, Va'amartem, and you say, Yitomim hayinu ve'ein av. We cry out to God. This is taken from the book of Echa, the book of Lamentations, which we read on Tisha B'Av, and which is Jeremiah the prophet is describing the pain, the anguish that the Jewish people are feeling about the destruction of the temple and having to go into exile. And the terminology that is used in the book of Lamentations is that we call out to God and we say, we are orphans. We have no parent. God says, this is what you say. Chayechem, I swear by your lives. Af ha-goel sha'ani atid lahamid lochem b'madai. The Redeemer who I in the future will establish for you in Persia, lo yiye lo avaim, will not have a mother or father. You cry that you feel that you are orphaned, that you are hopeless. The Midrash seems to say that's advantageous to you. That's going to be serving you in good stead. Why? Because in the future, I'm going to establish the Redeemer, someone who's going to help you out of a situation, specifically someone who has no parent and is an orphan. That's what the Midrash says. Now, I don't know about you, but that begs the question. What is that supposed to mean? How could that possibly be a positive? Everybody who's lost a loved one, that can't be positive. It's a negative feeling. You feel grief. You feel sad. You feel depressed. You feel lonely. God says you're crying out that you feel hopeless and helpless. Don't worry. It's great that it turned out that way, because there's going to be an Esther who's going to be an orphan and is going to save you. How are we to understand this Midrash? So we have to take one step backwards. We know that in the Torah, in terms of character development, it's incumbent upon us to be careful and sensitive to the needs and the well-being of others. That's a part and parcel of who we are. We need to be careful. It's called chesed, kindness. But the Torah in certain places goes above and beyond and says certain people, certain categories of people, you have to be extra careful. Never to hurt their feelings. Never to oppress or say something to make them feel bad. There are three categories of people that fit into that, that there's an additional prohibition. You have a general prohibition of not to do that to anybody, but to these people, it's even more. Who are they? There's three categories.
Orphans.
Widows. Orphans. Widows.
Widows.
Orphans. Who? Orphans.
Who did you say, Sandy?
Orphans.
We got orphans. We got widows.
Children.
No.
Those, poor.
Those you are supposed to oppress.
Poor. Poor.
The poor. Does it say the poor? I don't think it says not to oppress them. There are other prohibitions regarding the poor.
Stranger.
Strangers, right.
Strangers.
Converts. That's correct. That's correct. Those three, there's an additional prohibition. You have to be super careful. In fact, the verse reads as follows. Kol almana v'yatom lo ta'anun. Any widow or orphan you shall not oppress. The verse continues. And God says, because if you do, ki yitzak elai, when they cry out to me, shamoa eshma tzaakato, I will certainly hear and listen to their voice of oppression. It's interesting. What the verse is telling us, different than any other time. Listen, anybody who calls out to God, we believe, will listen. But the terminology in that verse says that it's immediate. I will readily listen to what they're crying about and exact retribution accordingly. There's no waiting period. It's not like, you know, being in my other Zoom call where you first in the waiting room until I decide to let you in. That's normal. That's when we pray. God has his timetable as to when and how to answer it. But when it comes to these categories of people, God says, I'm immediately ready and attentive. And as soon as they cry out, bam, I'm going to do what I have to do. Why? Why is it specifically by these people? So the great commentator Nachmanides says an amazing insight. He says, because these people are the most alone in their life. They feel that they have no longer any natural allies. The widow feels, now that her husband is no longer here, who's going to be her protector? The children who lack a parent, they feel alone. Their normal, natural allies that are there to protect them, they're not there anymore. And they feel that loneliness like nobody else. God says, for them, I will be their protector. I will be there for them. Well, once you understand that God says that a person who feels that sense of loneliness or hopelessness and helplessness, really, God says, I will step in because they have no one else. And the only one that they can turn to is, so to say, their Father in heaven. I will be there for them. That's a tremendous insight. But I want you to hear this carefully. It's not just a cool or a very convenient concept. This has very practical ramifications. You have to understand that when it comes to the realization that I am alone and I cannot rely either on my own ability or rely on who someone else's ability, and I turn to the one and only thing that could help me, that's when he does. Think about us. When we feel secure because we have the wealth, we have the health, we have the brain power, we have the physical strength, we have everything we need, how much do we really dig deep within ourselves and ask God to help us? We don't feel it as much. But when we start to feel a little more vulnerable because we're going through an economic downturn, or we're going through a pandemic where our health is now very much in jeopardy, of where my physical strength is beginning to wane because I'm getting older, we see things a little bit differently. And we don't necessarily rely on our own or that of those we always count on. They're not necessarily able. and we start to turn and turn to the only true source who can help us. It's at those moments, God says, when you come to that realization that you cannot rely on your own strengths and ability or even that of others, then you merit divine assistance like you've never felt before. You then fall into that category of being a widow or an orphan because you no longer can rely on anyone else. It's an interesting way of looking at life. There's no reason why we have to wait till we are actual widows or orphans. There's no reason for that. If we went with the mentality that I shouldn't rely on my own abilities, whether it be wealth, health, or otherwise, then we turn to God. And when we do that with a true sense of I need your help, God says, I will listen. I will grant you divine assistance. You know where the proof of this is? The third category. What's the reason why we shouldn't oppress a convert or stranger? Why? The Torah gives us a very simple reason.
We were strangers in Egypt.
We were. So what? But I'm no longer. Why should I be so super? Okay, I get it. I don't go there. Right? You can listen to people who have gotten themselves out of difficult situations and they have zero patience and tolerance for those who are in their old situation. There's nothing worse. I hope I'm not offending anyone, but there's nothing worse, as they say in Yiddish, of a fabrenta, right? Recovering alcoholic, right? The recovering alcoholic has no patience for the alcoholic anymore. Don't you know you're killing yourself? Really? A few years ago, I could have sworn that was you at the bar. Right? They've lost touch. They can no longer relate to what that old, don't make the same mistake I did. Don't do this. Relax. Yes, the person has to find their way. I'm not suggesting that keep doing the bad behavior, but you have to have the patience for what it was like back then. The Torah says, you must always remember you were a stranger in that land, in Egypt. You were a foreigner. You remember how that felt when you were enslaved and you had no one to turn to? You remember that? Now that you're free, don't ever forget it. You better remember that feeling of helplessness, of feeling out of place. Don't ever forget that. What did you do when you were helpless in that situation? You cried out to God, didn't you? And God came and saved you. Yeah, that's what you got to remember. As a general principle, when we come to that realization that we cannot rely on our own devices and we turn to God, that's when you get extra divine assistance. But it has to start, and this is important, it has to start, the first step is us. We have to take that first step. In order to facilitate that kind of treatment, that extra measure of help from God, we need some corresponding trait in kind of some action down here below. That's how it works. We've said this before. In the yin-yang relationship between us and God, God will respond to us the way we respond to God. But who takes the first step? We have to. The minute, right? Think about Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. The terminology that we talk about, that Shabbat in between, it's known as Shabbat Shuva, right? The Shabbos of repentance. Where's it comes from? Because the first two words of the Haftorah that's read that week is called Shuva Yisrael. Return Israel, come back to God. And the Talmud says, yeah, but there's another verse that says, God says, I'll take you back. Make up your mind. Do we return or does God, who comes towards whom? Do we go to God or does God come to us? The Talmud says, God comes to you after you take the first step of coming to him. You take one tiny step, he takes one giant leap towards you. But you have to take that first step. That's how it works. So now I'm going to turn this around on you, ladies and gentlemen. And now that you understand the concept, I'm going to ask you, where did the Jews, both in the story of Egypt, and more importantly and relevant for tonight, is where in the story of Purim, did we do that to merit the divine assistance to get out of the trouble? What did we do? What do you think? Let's start with Purim and make it so in case you get lost in the way. Let's start with Purim.
We fasted.
We fasted. Okay. That's true.
Maybe 3 days or something.
3 days. That's what Esther said. Fast, gather the Jews and fast for 3 days. Okay. I'm going to argue that something even earlier. An action that showed this concept. I'll give you a hint. We started with it. What, David?
This isn't the idea that there was a nation within a nation Esther, that the king was concerned about, right? That Mordecai was.
Go ahead.
So Mordecai's was counseling the king that there was a nation within the nation that it would be a threat.
Well, it wasn't Mordecai that offered. That was Haman.
Haman.
Haman had that. Correct. Yep. Correct. But you're right. But I'm looking at it. So what did we do that showed that we don't rely on ourselves and we look to the helplessness and know that we can rely on God? I'm going to argue and say that's the story of Mordecai and Esther. What is a better example of setting, the epitome of showing that I will care about those who feel alone, those who feel lost and helpless? I feel that way in my relationship with God at this time period. The Jews are lost in exile. The Jews are getting a decree of pure and total annihilation. What are we going to do? Mordecai, what do we do? The answer is show God the same way you're asking that you feel helpless and you want God to take care of you. Well, then you do the same thing for those who are helpless, which is exactly what Mordecai does. Mordecai takes in the girl who has no parents. She is as alone and helpless as one can be. In fact, the Talmud says she didn't become an orphan. She was born an orphan. Her father died when her mother was pregnant, and the mother died in childbirth. Esther never met either parent. How sad. That is the epitome of being alone. And Mordecai says we need to do something about it. So Mordecai makes that point of saying, I will take Esther into my home and I will raise her and show her that she's not alone. She's not helpless. When we do an act like that, God sees it and says, you feel helpless, you feel alone, I'm there for you. The perfect person to epitomize that when we feel alone and we turn to God is Esther. She's the perfect hero of the story, because when she felt alone, Mordecai reached out and took care of her. We want God to do the same thing here. That's why there's a special mitzvah on Purim of the Rambam. Maimonides puts it as, there's a mitzvah of misameach lev, to gladden the heart of aniyim, poor people, the yatomim, and orphans. It's an unusual. Usually you just say, you take care of the poor. The Rambam, Maimonides, adds the word and says, on Purim there's a special mitzvah to take care of the vulnerable. Not just the poor, but the orphan too, and the widow too. In a non-COVID year, I would recommend highly that when you have your Purim meal, invite at least one person who needs it. Not just your friends. Don't just do it for your friends. That's nice. But reach out to someone who maybe this year doesn't have a Purim Suda because their spouse died, or they're divorced, or who knows what. This is the meal in which you show definitively, I care for the vulnerable, God says, then I see this, I too will care for the vulnerable, you. That's the equation. It's an amazing insight. It's the question I've been asking for years. Why Mordechai and Esther? Why are they the heroes of the story? Is there anything in their background that led them to this? You see, when you read the story now and you pick it up from the story of Ahasuerus as a party, we've heard this as kids, we know this, but what's their background? Why are they the appropriate heroes of the story? We're not told that in the Megillah, but we are. Because if you read the introductions about them, it's exactly what it tells you. You know what Esther's claim to fame is? She's an orphan. She knows what it means to be alone. Why is Mordechai a hero? Because he takes care of the orphan. He knows that he has to step up to help. These are the kinds of personalities that make it appropriate to be the right heroes of the story. I'll show you how far this goes. It's not just in the story of Purim. It's also in the story of the Exodus. The Torah tells us that when the Jews left Egypt, the Torah uses a very strange word. It says, Vachamushim alu b'nei Yisrael, that the children of Israel went up, and the word that's used is chamushim. Rashi brings from an early source that it means from the word chamesh, right? You hear the word chamesh or chumash, right? The number five. Vachamushim, that the Jews left, unfortunately, only as one-fifth. Only one-fifth of the population actually left Egypt. The vast majority of the Jews in Egypt either died out or assimilated, and they didn't leave. It's a scary thought. That's Rashi, and he brings from early source. But there are other commentators that see it a little differently. One in particular understands that the word vachamushim, also a play on words with the number five, but he understood it that each family within the Jewish nation had a total, each had five youngsters, five children. They went out as grouplets of five. Okay, and that's significant why. Okay. I mean, if you're playing Jewish Trivial Pursuit and someone asks that as the bonus question, you'll know the answer, but who cares? Like, what is so significant that they were groups of five kids to each? I told you that if you want to put it in the negative perspective, four-fifths of the Jewish people did not merit to leave Egypt. But the Midrash tells us that that's only the adults. The adults are the ones who died. The adults, what happened to all those children? Says the Midrash, every family that left took the responsibility of taking four more. So that in effect, the four-fifths, the four, now gets subsumed into the one that left, so that ultimately all the children were cared for. Think about that for a second. You don't think it was hard enough to just leave at the Exodus? They had been there for so long. The level of craziness the night before they left with the death of the firstborn, and God says, stay inside, and oh, by the way, eat that Paschal lamb, and don't go out of the house, and there's noise, and Paro's running around like a meshugana. Where's Moshe? Where's Moshe? Get out of here! He's going crazy, right? You can imagine, oh, and they don't have time to bake their challah. They got to be out of there. And oh, by the way, do you think you can handle four more kids while you're at it? Oh, by the way, you know, but that's what we do. Here again, God sees we take the first step to care for those who don't have the ability to care for themselves. They're alone. The orphans. Oh, you're taking care of them? Don't worry, God says, I'll take care of you. And you have the clouds of glory, you have the manna, you have the well. All their needs are taken care of. Why? Because we showed that we care about the others. Think about it. They're about to enter a desert, a desolate area. There's no one to rely on. except God. It's perfect. They needed some action that would be corresponding, that will take care of others. Yes, God will take care of us. That's how it works. Now perhaps we can understand. Esther felt helpless after the loss of her parents. Mordecai acted accordingly and became, so to say, the champion of orphans. And therefore, the two of them are the tag team to merit to bring the salvation for the Jewish people. This is what they bring to the table. What's message number one for us? Is that we need to prepare ourselves always in life, not just around the time of Purim, and not specifically with orphans and widows or converts. It's a general principle that if we want God to shower us with success, to shower us with blessing, to shower us with all that we truly want in life, then we have to play the same, we have to do the same thing. We have to make sure that we have that same feeling that I have no one to rely on except Hashem. We are like orphans. That's how the mentality has to be for us. And number two is, like I mentioned earlier, is do something concretely to facilitate that action. Take care of somebody vulnerable. Take care of somebody. Reach out. Doesn't mean you have to take them into your home and make it, you know, one of your family members, although that's nice. But do something for somebody who's in a difficult situation. I'll just tell you, again, I don't mean to toot my own horn, but I have this, and I try to remember this message. So my daughter, Brachi, my oldest, right? So she married into this wonderful family. And unfortunately, her mother-in-law passed away last year, suddenly. Terrible. I think I may have mentioned this to you. Right. Terrible, terrible. So I happened to have on my calendar, I put an alarm, right, to let me know birthdays and anniversaries, because, you know, I'm very forgetful. So thankfully I put it on my calendar. So I get an alert yesterday that it's Brachi's in-law's anniversary. And I went back and forth in my head. Should I text him? Because I'm sure it's a rough day yesterday. It's his, you know, it's his anniversary and his spouse, his wife is not there anymore. I debated, should I, shouldn't I? So about 10 o'clock last night, I texted him, telling him I was thinking of him and that I debated in my head whether I should or shouldn't and how much we love him and, you know, we're there for him. He was so appreciative. He said, I didn't tell my kids. I didn't remind anybody. I didn't want to make a big deal of it, but thank you. Thank you for remembering. Okay. Is that going to change his life? No. Is that going to change my life? No. But for a brief moment, it sent a message that I know that you're in a vulnerable situation right now. You're hurting. You're not alone. We love you. That's meaningful. That's what we have to do. That is the message, or part A of the message, that I want to share, that you have to read the Megillah and see that what seemed to be just a nice, interesting fact that Esther is an orphan is in fact the critical link as to why she's the appropriate one, Mordecai being the appropriate one, the two of them, to bring about the salvation. Because that's what exactly we need to do. Show that we care about the helplessness, because ultimately we are helpless. We can't rely. This pandemic has taught us we cannot rely on diddly of what we have. Not our wealth, not our health, nothing. We do the best we can, but ultimately we are helpless. We're alone and we have no one to turn to except for God. This is part A. Any questions on this?
I would comment, Rabbi, that your call did change his life. He's going to remember that. It's going to sit in the back of his mind. He's going to bring it up as a warm tummy feeling that somebody cares. So
maybe. I just know it was something that needed to be done. It's hard. I debated it because on the one hand, I don't know. Everybody grieves and everybody deals with their own situation. And the last thing you need is a bombardment from other people. Oh, I hope you're doing okay. You're sick of answering that. But I have a wonderful relationship with him. So I think it was the right move. But here's a second part. And it's a deeper understanding. Let's put things in perspective here. Monroe, you mentioned, right? You mentioned that Mordecai comes from the tribe of Benjamin. Okay, in this interesting piece, and I don't think we'll have time to really explore it in full. But let's talk about this concept about Esther being an orphan again. Let's see how this works.
In what?
Orphan.
An orphan, okay? Who, if Mordecai and Esther are the heroes of the story, if you had to pick the one, there are many, but the number one villain in the story, you would pick?
Haman.
We would all pick Haman, okay? Ahasuerus, we can debate. I think most will fall on the side that he's not a good guy, but Haman is not a question. Haman, we are told from tradition, is a descendant from the nation known as Amalek. Okay, we've talked about this. Amalek is that nation that stands as the antithesis to the right values of godliness. They're on the opposite end of the spectrum. As much as the Jewish people are supposed to be the paradigm of virtue, Amalek is on the other side, the paradigm of evil. Okay, Haman is a descendant. Hold that thought for a moment. Let's fast forward. We're now February 24th, 2021. Yud Gimel Adar Tufshin Pei Al, the 13th day of Adar in 5781. Okay? We have been exiled from our home and from our temple over 2,000 years. Right? It's just about 2,000 years. Not yet, almost. 2,000 years. What exile are we in? It has a name. We know that in the story of Purim, it's known as the Persian exile. Paras, right? It's called Galut Madai or Paras, Persia. Which exile are we in now?
American.
America is not an American because 2,000 years ago, there was no America. I'm very patriotic, Sid, but the country is only 200 plus years old.
Egyptian exile? I
don't know. Is it what?
Egyptian.
No, because we left Egypt before we even went to Israel. Yes.
Okay. The Roman
is correct. This is considered the Roman exile. Correct, David. This is the Roman exile. They are the ones who destroyed the second temple in 70 CE, right? Almost 2,000 years ago, the Romans. And we've been exiled ever since. In Hebrew, the Romans are known as Edom. That's the name of their country. That's the name of their people, Edom. Now, if you know a little bit about history, Edom is actually the name that was given to a biblical character. No cheating, David. No Googling. Hey, hands off. Hands up in the air. Okay. Who's Edom? Who gets the name Edom or Adom?
Esau.
Ah, good old Yaakov's twin bro, Esau. Why is he given the name Edom or Adom? Because of the famous story of pour in the red lentil soup. The word Edom means red. So he's given the nickname Edom. Now, Edom's not the best guy. Esau's not the best guy. Again, not one of those that I would put in your, if you're looking for names for children and grandchildren in the Jewish book of names, Esau should not have an entry there. No, not even Edom. Okay. What is the one and only saving grace, the one commandment that Esau excelled in, not just did, but he excelled in it.
He honored his father.
Honoring his mother and father, mostly his father. In fact, the Talmud uses Esau as paradigm. There was a sage that was talking about how much he was doing for his mother, right? And the other sage turns to him and says, that's very nice, but you don't even reach the ankles of what Esau did for his father. Esau is like way up there at the top of the line. So listen to an incredible insight that I read this year. And I will grant you that on the surface, it sounds ironic. It almost sounds backwards. But allow me to do my best to explain it. And I hope that by the time we're done, you'll agree, and it is an incredible insight. There's a general rule. Let's say I want to go do a mitzvah. I have in mind, I know of somebody who is ill, and I want to go visit them. So I set a certain time. I set an alarm on my phone because I won't remember. So I put out, the alarm goes off. I got to go visit so-and-so. Right? Socially distant, fine. I get in my car and I'm about to go and the car doesn't start. Oh, great. Now I got to try jumping it. I got to call AAA. Make a long story short, AAA shows up an hour and a quarter later, of course, right? Even though their office is right around the corner. An hour and a quarter later, they're fine. Make a long story short, I missed my opportunity. I can't. I already have the next meeting. I can't. Question. Do I get credit for doing the mitzvah of visiting that sick person? Really? You think I get credit? I didn't do it. Alan, I didn't do it.
It's your, but your mind said you were going to do it and you were willing, and the fact that something prevented you to, out of your control from doing it makes it.
So are you saying that if I just intend to do something that I get credit for it? Is that what you're saying?
I think if you intend and try.
Oh, darn. Why'd you have to throw that in? Yeah, you're 100% right. The Talmud says explicitly that if a person intends to do a mitzvah and something out of his control, no negligence on his part, something prevents him from doing it, he's given credit as if he had done the mitzvah. That is fact. Now that you know these pieces of information, I'm going to ask you a difficult question. We've all, thank God, had or have parents. And we've done our best, perhaps, to honor them. But is there anybody on this call who can raise their hand proudly and say that they fulfilled the mitzvah 100%? Don't be shy. Don't be bashful. Come on. Now's not the time for humility. That's a different class. The answer is no. There's nobody. Why? Because we do try our best, but we're human. I can't say with a level of certainty that I fulfilled it with the proper focus, the proper intention, the proper mannerism, the appropriate time for it, the tone of voice. I mean, there's a million little things that could go wrong that often, almost always, go wrong. And I don't do it 100%. So now I'm going to turn it around on you, Alan. You told me, and I agreed with you, that if I intend to do a mitzvah and something prevents me from doing it, I'm given credit as if I did it. What level of credit? As if I had done it 70%? That had I done the mitzvah, I probably would have only done it 70. I'll give myself 80% credit? Or am I given full credit? What would you say now?
I would vote for full credit.
So you're a lenient marker. I mean, I would love to have taken a college course with you. Because if it was a true false and you wrote true and I was supposed to be false, you'd give me credit. I mean, you're just a lenient guy.
If I believe you, yeah, you get credit 100%.
I know. Rabbi, I knew you tried. That's good enough.
Maybe 50%.
You'd only get 50%. Right, Robin? You'd only get 50%.
Yes.
Well, thank God Alan's much closer to the right answer than you are. For all of our sakes. This is a novel understanding, and this is was the beautiful insight that I read. The fact that Esther does not have parents, do you think she felt bad about that? Do you think she felt, I know we spoke earlier that she felt loneliness and helpless, right? But do you think she felt that, oh, I missed an opportunity to honor my parents? I would vote yes. I would vote yes, she probably did. Nobody who's an orphan says, oh, thank God, I don't have to do that anymore, right? Nobody says that. We all want the opportunity to do it. And sadly, there comes a time of where we can't.
But if it was during birth, she doesn't have that recollection of actually
nothing to
having
do with
parents.
It, but it doesn't make a difference. The fact is she doesn't have a parent which she can show honor to. Every child wants, not because they love that they've been given so much. That's true. That is true. But there's a natural inclination. Of course, I want to know my parents. And of course, I would love to honor them and show them respect and love them. I was never given that opportunity, Esther said. So now, I'm going to ask you the question. Putting this all together, Alan, it comes out, based on your formulas, that Esther, not having parents, wanting to do the mitzvah of honoring parents, gets more credit than all of us who actually honored our parents. How ironic is that? Think about it. When we do it, we try our best and we shoot for 100%, but more likely than not, we don't hit it. But if you're not given the chance and you feel pain that you want to do it, not the guy who says, oh, thank God I can eat on Yom Kippur. I'm not feeling well. Oh, thank God I don't have to fast. You know, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about somebody who intrinsically wants to do it, but can't. Something out of their control. Says this article, this Sefer, you're given not 50%, not 75 or 80, you're given 100% credit on the highest level. Once you understand this concept, it will answer our original question, and with this we'll end. Why is it so significant that Esther is an orphan? Why is this appropriate for her to be the one to be the hero of the story? Because who is she up against? She's up against a man by the name of Haman. Haman is a descendant of Amalek, who is a grandson of Esav. Esav's big merit is his honoring parents. How are we going to beat that? How are we going to beat and defend against that? It's a great merit for Esav. Yeah, I know how to do it. Go toe-to-toe with him. But guys like you and me, we don't stand a chance, because Esav probably hit it at the 95 percentile. If we're lucky, we'll get to 75. But you know who can get better than 95?
Esther.
Esther can. Why? Because she does it. She wants it, but she can't have it. The wanting of it, the feeling, the pain of not being able to do it. You see, when the guy gets the flat tire and he wanted to go visit his friend, what's his reaction? Oh, thank God, I didn't really want to go visit Frank anyway, but I had to, right? That's one possibility. The other possibility is I feel terrible. I got to text him. I got to do something. That guy, when he feels the pain of not being able to do it, he's given 100% credit. And therefore, Esther gets 100% of honoring parents, which goes toe-to-toe with Haman, who's the descendant of Esau. Wow. That's why this one line that Esther is an orphan and more is critical to understanding this story. And you want to know? That's the only way we're going to get out of this exile too. As I mentioned to you, we are in the Roman exile. Rome, Edom, is Esau. So you know what 2,000 years of the last history for us, of persecution, of difficulties, that's probably wiped away all of the sins we've done. But you know what's still left? I still have to topple the main guy. I still got to go toe-to-toe with Esau in the mitzvah of honoring parents. I still got to defeat that. Listen to this last story. Last piece. There was a great, great, righteous individual who lived in Eretz Yisrael, and he passed away just about a year and a half ago. His name was Reb Aaron Leib Steinman, a tremendous, tremendous leader in the Jewish people. In the yeshiva world, his Torah knowledge was off the charts. I think he first started traveling to give inspiration to cities around the world. He started his travels when he was already in his 90s. That's when he started. An unbelievable man. He was asked this question. Someone asked him and said, why is this exile lasting so long? In all the different troubles and tribulations that the Jewish people have gone through in their history, we've never had one this long. Even Egypt, which was the root of all of it, only lasted 400 years. This is 2000. Why is it taking so long? They asked him. He turned around and he said to them, I have a question for you. Right away, you know he's Jewish, right? I have a question for you. He says, why is it that there's never been a case in history of where people live this long? Yes, I know in the time of Adam and Eve and everybody lived so long, but since things got normalized after the flood, the normal lifespan, if you were lucky, you made it to 70. 80 was like, oh my God, that's like gravy. Now, over the last 60 years, why is it that we get to live so long? This is what Rabbi Steinman turned to this guy and said, you answer this question. Why now all of a sudden we get to live so much longer? Yeah, I know medical technology, but the end of the story is that we are living longer. We never had that in history. Why? Rabbi Steinman answered the following. He said the two are linked. If the reason why we're still in exile under Roman, under ace of rulership, that means we have to go toe-to-toe with him. The one thing that Esav has going is honoring parents. So God is giving us an opportunity that we've never had before of honoring older parents. We've never had an opportunity taking care of elderly, frail. Yeah, okay, maybe they're living longer, but the difficulties get harder and harder. You know why, said Rav Steinman? Because this is our final test. Just like it was in the story of Purim, just as it was in the story of the Exodus. This is the last step, the last hurdle. So if we're going to go toe-to-toe with Esav, then we got to step up to the plate. And therefore, he said, the exiles long, you know, that we're at the stage now of it coming to an end is directly linked to the opportunity to honor our parents. This is what it is. And that's how they got out of the story in Purim. That's how they got out of the story of Egypt. And that's how we're going to get out of this. This is what he told them. To me, this hit like a ton of bricks. Because for better or worse, my in-laws are not well medically. And it's been challenging, especially in COVID. But that's what we have to do. When I go ahead, not me, when anybody goes ahead and deals with that difficult challenge with a parent. And unfortunately, not everybody has that anymore. But if you do, you have an opportunity to do something like Esther. You have that opportunity. You want to do it. Like, I want to go visit my in-laws, but I can't right now. COVID doesn't allow. Perhaps, I'm not saying for sure, but perhaps my pain of not visiting them is worth more than had I visited them. That's an amazing insight. I'm not looking to get out of it. I'd love to do it again. But understand what the message that's being conveyed here. That one line, that Esther is an orphan, she has no parent, that is critical. It's a key to understanding why, A, she is the right person to play that role, why Mordecai is the right person to play that role, and what merit we had to get out. That is what it means, little orphan Esther. That's the name of this class, Little Orphan Esther. I don't know if she had the red hair, but certainly the sun will come out tomorrow.
She had a spaghetti.
What do you think?
So I'm sorry. So to tie it in for the last point was that to go toe to toe now, we have to honor our parents who are living longer.
Yeah. In other words, if our parents, if the mortality rate, if that people died in their 50s and 60s, so then we're not given too many opportunities. But when they live 70, 80, 90 and above, so they need more help. So this is our chance. This is our opportunity to provide the honor and respect properly so that we can be as good as, if not better than Esav was.
Thanks, because similar to you, I'm in the same situation with my mom doing it for a year.
It's challenging. It is challenging. But it's a great insight. It really is. The first half of the class I had seen before, but this other insight about almost doing a 180 of where ironically you get more, that was a new way of understanding for me this year. So I wanted to share that. Any questions? Sharon.
Actually, it's not for you. As for Sid and Michelle. Quick question. Is Beth Shalom doing a Megillah reading or how are they doing it?
Yes, ma'am. I'm part of it. I'm actually part of it.
Okay.
So yeah, we're doing it. Tomorrow night at 6:30, there's a Zoom link and then the rabbi's doing Megillah.